Hello, I'm Jeremy Rivera, your unscripted podcast host. I'm here with Melissa Jaskowitz, who is with Leveling the Fields. Not field, it's multiple fields that she's leveling. She's going to tell us what that means in a moment. But first, I got to ask her the question. Why should we trust you as a marketing expert?
Wow. I guess you probably shouldn't. I mean, you don't know me, you know? Let's see what gives me trust. I guess background. Been in sales and marketing for over 20 years and somehow I'm still standing. So I guess there's the little bit of clout that we can all kind of say we have with this many years of experience.
I think, you know, there's a variety of things that one does to stay in a single industry for 20 years. So I think that cumulatively starts to count at some point. It's crazy, right? Like there's this imposter syndrome. Like I've been doing this for 20 years and I still second guess myself when I deliver that SEO audit. I still second guess myself when I, you know, jump on that call. But I also then talk to folk and I'm like, wow, they really have zero clue how any of this works. So
everyone's just speaking it, let's be honest.
But tell me some of those pieces cumulatively. What are some of those big blocks that you did in those 20 years? Is there any standout client or project or company that you worked with that was formulative to your current worldview?
My worldview? Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've been across a couple of different industries at this point. I've been in sports, obviously, was my longest. I was in pro sports for over 15 years. Before that, I've always been in tech, though. So I was in hardened technology for quite some time. I used to sell hardened computers into the three-letter agencies.
Okay.
And that was pretty interesting. I mean, we saw some really, really cool tech. And I think that that's always been kind of the common denominator of everything I've done. It always comes back to tech. So I think with that comes that excitement of we've just really always been evolving in that area in the world. And so it's just so cool to see where we are now, where we were, and things that you thought were like so cool and so amazing, like are just like common now. I mean, I remember we went to Booz Allen in Hamilton and we did like this technology petting zoo. And I was 16, 17 at the time. And the guy took his mouse and went across to the other screen. And all of us were like, oh my God, that's so cool. And to see that evolving, I think looking back now and seeing all those points where we thought something was so revolutionary. And then you fast forward 5 years and there's something even more revolutionary. So I think that just kind of knowing that something new is coming all the time and curious about what it's going to be, I think that that's really kind of shaped a lot of my journey.
I was just talking about this with my wife because she's like, the rate of advancement of technology seems to be accelerating. And of course, I have to be the naysayer. I'm like, well, actually, you know, according to that law of improvement, we're actually behind because batteries took so much longer to advance in their capability for storage. Mostly for mobile devices. It's been a big limiting factor, but there have been, you know, larger advances in batteries, but it has, you know, like I'm thinking back to, you know, I'm a millennial and I grew up and we had a rotary phone, you know, we were excited when we got our 286 PC in our home and I had Lemmings as my first.
Lemmings, I love that game.
But there was that transitory moment where, you know, like, hey, if they needed to get a hold of me, like they yelled from the front yard and hopefully, you know, I had to stay within relative earshot and get home before the sunset. And those were the rules of communication. Now I'm like, like there's, air tags for kids and like people are sewing it into their clothes and, you know, is the, your remote tracking for your tablet on, you know, my daughter's lost her tablet, you know, twice. My, So the advancement of technology has increased, and I think it does impact the way that we interact with the world and kind of changes the shape of things for the next generation.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was the same way. You came on, you were home when the streetlights came on. If the streetlights came on and you weren't home, you were in trouble. And that was that. And, you know, I have two teenagers and I track their phones. I know where they are pretty much at any moment. So it's definitely very different. And I think that they, for them to kind of go backwards, like if we drop them into like 1985, they would be very confused as to how do you even navigate communication for plans.
Yeah.
Like, how do you do that? And it's like, yeah, we had to make plans. You had to stick to them because everyone knew where to meet and when to meet. You couldn't just change on the fly or cancel last minute. Like, you had to tell someone. So yeah, that's even at that base level. Yeah, totally different.
So what you're working on for the next generation, what would you say that looks like?
I think everything we're doing really is working on the next generation. So our organization is on a mission to get more women into places of leadership using sports as the catalyst. So what we're actually doing day in and day out is going on site to elementary schools and introducing sports to girls from third to fifth grade. And the whole intention of that is to allow them to get more exposure, find what they love, find what they're good at, and therefore giving, you know, introducing them to a kind of a lifelong journey of confidence and resilience and grit and all these things. So that's really our goal for the next generation and the women that are coming up next, is to make sure that they feel empowered and feel confident to do whatever it is that drives them, whatever they see out there that they want to go after. We want to make sure that they have the tools and the confidence to get there.
That makes sense. I have a 13-year-old daughter, and, you know, last year, you know, my wife enrolled her in a local karate dojo, and, you know, she's on the autism spectrum somewhere, and definitely ADHD. Like, I've got the ADHD. My wife's a bit autistic, and so we needed something, you know, physical for her to do, but, you know, needed to find like a good niche. And I have to say, I did carry some animus over from my early experiences with sports, where I was the runt of the litter. I was the person on the baseball team only because they literally could not play a game without me as a player. So I'm standing in the right field. It's the last game, the last pitch, last person up, and all I have to do is not strike out. And I struck out. So.
No. Not the memory you want.
I had to overcome that because I knew that, you know, she needed, you know, a friend grouping that was outside of the context of homeschool, you know, and giving her another place in entry. And she's really like taken to it. And now she can kick people in the head really well because she's almost as tall as I am when she's 13. Like she was sparring the other day. I'm like, Noelle, boot to the head. And she didn't catch the reference. So I showed her the video and that, you know, with the Taekwondo leap. And she was just busted up laughing for like 30 minutes, wanted to watch it 12 times. And then next time she sparred, I'm like, boot to the head, just boot to the head. And so she's just kicking this guy's head.
I love it. Well, it does. It's interesting when, you know, I always say all girls are good at something, but we're not all good at the same thing. So you can't hand everyone a soccer ball and be like, all right, we're done here. Like, some of girls love soccer, but some hate it. And it's like, you can't just keep dumping everyone in the same pond and expecting them to be fine. And so it's as a parent, it's the most amazing thing when you find when you find that your child has found their thing, you know, whether it's, you know, professional, you know, sandcastle making or volleyball. I mean, it's like whatever it is, you just want them to find their thing. And so the more things that we expose them to, the greater the likelihood that they're going to find one of those things that's theirs. And I think that there's so much behind that, behind finding your thing and feeling like, ooh, I like this. I'm good at it. I have confidence now because, like, you know, I found something that really kind of, you know, gels with me. And I think there's also a part of like identity. Yeah. You guys start to identify with that. And I think there's so much that we learn as we grow on who we really are and how we want to be perceived, how others perceive us, and how we perceive ourselves and finding our identity. And I think that finding your thing, be it, you know, music or sports or whatever, it does help with that. It helps you kind of connect to something, and then you don't feel so lost.
What's been some of the challenges of, you know, the group dynamic? You know, because sports are good on certain levels because you're introduced to, you know, the challenges. You know, there's the game itself or the points that you have to score and the physicality of it. You can level up those things. But what have been some of the things organizationally, you know, to keep in mind anytime that you put together, you know, 13, 14 year olds, they don't have a concrete sense of right or wrong developmentally. You know, they developmentally, they're looking to their peer group. So if you put a peer group of 14-year-olds together, sometimes you get some very questionable decisions as far as behavior or activity. So,
yeah, that is definitely true. I think the good part here is that we do middle school clinics, but our main flagship program, which is in Power Play, is 3rd through 5th grade. So we've got like 8 to 11-year-olds. So it's a little easier then, but the one thing that we really pride ourselves on is we actually hire teachers from that school to be the coaches in our program. And by doing that, we are putting money back into teachers' pockets, which is, you know, wonderful. But for us as an organization, it's really great because there's already a connection. They're already seen as teachers, they're respected. They know the kids automatically know the hierarchy. They know who's in charge. And the teachers know the kids on a certain level. I mean, some of them, you know, are different grades or what have you, but it makes that process, that transition from the school day into sports a lot easier. And you're always going to have, you know, kids that kind of step outside those boundaries. But in hiring teachers, they automatically know how to handle that because that's what they're doing all day, every day. And so that's really been a saving grace as to having these teachers come in as our coaches who already have these incredible skill sets on how to manage that age group, how to manage a classroom. They're just, you know, all those skills are really, really beneficial.
What about sensory differences or ADD, ADHD, autism?
Yeah.
What's been your viewpoint on that, either personally or as an organization?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up, you know, dyslexic and ADD. I was diagnosed back in the 80s. So a long time ago. So it's very near and dear to my heart. And I think that the biggest disservice we have done to especially ADD and ADHD kids is limit the amount of physical activity. You know, we should be having PE every day and we're not. So you can't take those kids with a lot of energy and very fast brains and then expect them to sit still for 8 hours. That's not how it works. And so by introducing these sports to these girls, especially the ones that run fast, this is a fantastic avenue to get some of that energy out, to express themselves in other ways. And the other thing is, you know, I wasn't a great student. I struggled a lot in school, but I really excelled when it came to certain sports. And I was good at it, but I loved it. And we were all more equal, you know? And so I think that that was a really nice thing to have. And you can really only get that in that kind of situation. So we had seen, you know, as a whole, as a nation, like when you have children that run, their brains run quickly, getting their body to move on a more regular basis helps to kind of level that out. So I do think that this is fantastic. We had one girl who, I mean, she was getting in trouble all the time in school.
Mm-hmm.
She was just, you know, she couldn't sit still, getting in trouble, pushing buttons. And when we introduced the Leveling the Fields program to that school, the teacher came back, the coach came back to me and said, you know, hey, just a heads up. We got 4 weeks in. She's like, and I started using you as kind of like a, hey, like, we'd really hate to miss, you know, we'd really hate to stay late, or like, you know, she's basically using us as like this, like, let's be really on today so that we can get to Leveling the Fields quicker. And we can do, and she said that they started to change. The days where they had Leveling the Fields as that goal to get to, she saw a lot less disruption in the classroom. The kids were so excited about that they didn't want to lose it. Now, we don't really want to be, you know, we don't ever want to be taken away. So we tell them, don't do that. But they were so excited for it. And I think that that's just a really, really beautiful thing. And I think that's extremely important for kids who don't necessarily do great in a normal core setting.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the organization of your organization. How have you organized the organs of your organization?
Yeah. How do you do what you do? So we are a primarily volunteer organization, and we have six committees. So we have a marketing committee, a programs committee, development, grants, events, and operations. And at the top of each of those committees, we have a committee chair. And then that person has committee members on their team, usually 2 to 3. And then we have what are called our contributors. So our contributors are people that maybe just do like one project, or they're just on like one task where they don't really need to, they just kind of do their thing siloed, or they're working for a finite period of time. And so each of those committees meets either once a week or once every other week. And then I meet with my committee chairs once a month as a group, but I meet with each of them individually every single week so that we're on the same page, what they're working on, what we need them to be working on. It's been absolutely amazing to see these women get on board and just be like, yep, let's do this. And just to bring in all these incredibly smart and intelligent and skilled people into my universe has just elevated our entire game. So I always tell people, like, I'm really, really good at like this little bit of stuff, but I need people that are good at all these things if we want to be as big and as successful as I see us being. And so I tell my kids all the time, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. So, yeah, you know, you need to be around people that are going to push you, that are going to elevate you, that are going to make you think, and really justify what you're doing, because you need to know all the holes because you need to be ready for them. And so that's kind of how we operate. We use Slack every day, all day, to communicate in each of our channels and make sure that everyone knows what's going on. It's been pretty impressive. We get together for events that we have. We have fundraising events throughout the year, little ones and big ones. And then twice a year, we do an all hands meeting. We all get together, you know, all 30 of us, and we do a big presentation on kind of like, okay, here's where we are, here's where we want to be. The teams that maybe have only seen each other on Zoom get to meet in person. So that's kind of one of my favorite things that we do throughout the year.
So what's the biggest learning curve that you've had to overcome in transferring your sales skills, your marketing skills to the world of nonprofit?
The biggest problem that I have had is asking for money. I am not good at that. It's very hard to get in front of someone who you're friends with or you have a relationship with and say, hey, we are we have a school on a wait list and we need $14,000 to be able to pull that school off of a wait list. Can you give me $100? And it's just awkward. It's just very awkward. I've been in sales, you know, the whole ride up, but I've always had something that it was always been, you know, business to business, or I was holding something that I could say, do you want this? And so it's a different vibe. So it's just tricky. Obviously I'm getting better at it, because if you don't get good at fundraising and nonprofit, you will drown.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, that's been a very interesting transition. I'm very much more business development than I am sales. And so the relationship part of things, that's where I really thrive and that's what I love.
Yeah.
But that, you know, asking is kind of awkward, but, you know, every day I get a little bit better at it.
Yeah.
I just don't want anyone to ever feel like I'm only maintaining the relationship with them for, you know, them to fund my nonprofit, because that's never the case. And it's not nice. I truly care about all the people in our orbit and, you know, the people that do donate to us. I'm just so incredibly grateful. And I want to get to know who they are, why they donated to us, why they like us, and what we can do to make sure that they feel appreciated. And I think that the relationship side there is very similar, and just trying to kind of make sure that the people in your orbit, you know, they were clients, now they're donors, and make sure that they know how much we care about them and appreciate them and like them in our world.
It seems to me that a lot of the work of a nonprofit is really like gaining that visibility for either your mission, the outcome of that mission, you know, because if you're, I worked with, you know, how was it? AmeriCorps when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And, you know, got to work, had the benefit of a great program where we trained trainers for a computer education program at local churches. So we would basically be planting computer school seeds to upskill people so they didn't work fast food anymore, but they could get an office job, you know, because, you know, the kind of feeling trapped, you know, you're 30, 40 and you got into some trouble with drugs and, you know, you don't have the skills of, you know, making an Excel sheet. You know, you don't have the basic, you know, computer automation skills that just people take for granted in an office workspace. I had one lovely lady. Oh my gosh, Carol. The first class, I said, okay, take your mouse up and move the cursor over to the icon. She takes up her mouse, puts it on the screen, and moves it over. But by the end of the semester, she was emailing spreadsheets, and she was able to get a secretary job after that. And so
that's amazing.
But the job wasn't done because we still had to tell people what we had done. So that, you know, mm-hmm. the second half of the fulfilling the grant was writing emails and, you know, connecting with the church board so that we could have, you know, the pastor stand up and recognize the people who had graduated that computer class, you know, to gain visibility for the next round for it. And there's kind of mm-hmm. that circle on it. I'm curious, either in your quest for visibility or in your workflow to get that visibility, have you leveraged AI at all? I know my friend, you know, Matt Brooks of Esoteric refers to AI as the worst customer support representative if you don't educate them, but the best if you give them something to feed on. So what has that looked like for you?
I use AI all day, every day. So I have a Claude and Chat that I both have a paid subscription to both of those, and I have trained them well. I think that in terms of how we use them for visibility, I think it's more, I don't typically use them as much for external, like creating marketing graphics or things of that nature, but I use them a lot in terms of drafting emails to specific people to making sure that what I'm writing is strong enough. I'll write something and then I'll put it in a chat and say, okay, clean this up or make this better or soften this up. And then I'll reread it and edit that. And so it's like having, I really, really love to collaborate. And working from home and being, you know, the only staple in the organization that's not, you know, a volunteer and not gonna, you know, in the revolving door, it's been nice to actually have like this AI collaborator to go back and forth with to say, well, here's what I'm thinking. Well, no, that. And it's really funny because the nicer you are to your AI bot, the nicer they are to you. And so often it'll say, you know, that's great thinking, Melissa. And I'm like, well, thank you. But no, we in grant writing, it's very, very helpful in grant writing because I've been training my chat for 2.5 years. I've been training Claude for about 6 months. And that's been really amazing. I've got Claude connected to my Gmail so I can say, hey, go through and clear out any of the bounce back emails. Give me a Excel list. And then I upload that into HubSpot and say, tag all these as bounced. So it's been, it's been a huge part of our day-to-day life and how we're doing things on the back end. From an awareness standpoint, we have 1,000 followers on Instagram.
Yeah.
And I copy and pasted every single one of them and dropped them into Claude and said, of all these people, who would be the best to collaborate with to expand our IG reach? And it came back and told me. So it's been really, really cool and fascinating. And the better I get at my prompts and what I wanted to do and thinking about things in terms of everything I do every day, my thought is, could I put this in the club? Could chat do this? Like, so that's been really cool.
Yeah. I mean, like Ignivido did a study that 80% of businesses don't respond within the first day, even when people are reaching out and trying to get business from them, you know, particularly in the home service sector. Now I'll flub the exact numbers and my own Claude will yell at me later when I'm processing this transcript of then you said the stat wrong again. But it occurs to me that, you know, processing, you know, your inflow of potential donors or messages or connections, like that's just as important for a nonprofit as it is for somebody who's selling for it, because, you know, people get busy and while the mood strikes, I'm like, oh, I should check into that level playing field. You know, they'll forget it the next week and think, ah, why do I need to, you know, level my foundation? What was that again?
What was I doing? Yeah, there's actually a stat out there. I don't know it off the top of my head about the time it takes a nonprofit to respond to a volunteer inquiry and how quickly you respond is correlated with the likelihood of the person like coming back on or staying on or what have you. So I don't know all the stats behind it, but I interviewed someone the other day for a volunteer position that we have open, and she told me that she's been volunteering for a local shelter, and when she reached out to them, she didn't hear back for almost a year. And I said, what? And now that's an extreme one.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that there is a, you know, it got lost or whatever, but you do hear a lot about people that reach out to volunteer and they don't hear back for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Or what have you. So I think that putting a volunteer manager in place for us was incredibly important.
Right.
And we get back to people, I mean, within a couple of hours. So we also know that sometimes because of what we do, we have a lot of interest and that, which has been amazing. A lot of people want to be a part of what we're doing.
Yeah.
But also we're not your typical show up, pack a bag, and then leave. Like, we're not your typical daily volunteer organization. Like, we expect a lot from our volunteers, and they're really the ones running our organization. So we do get that a lot where people will reach out and be like, I want to volunteer with the girls. I'm like, you can help us with the summer camp, but during the year, no. Like, we have paid, hired, structured programming. Like, this is our, we pay our coaches. We have them go through a 4-hour training before this, before the program starts, before the season. Like, we can't just take somebody off the street and be like, sure, you know, like, we have to get them sled checked. We have to, you know, there's just so many hoops to jump through when you are going on campus to an elementary school.
Yeah.
And we have all that down. So there is a little bit of a misdemeanor some or misunderstanding sometimes of what people think volunteering for us looks like and what it actually is.
Yeah.
But again, we just kind of have to take that in stride and explain really, really clearly what we're looking for. And if someone's not really into that, we just, you know, hey, if you want to join our mailing list, donate, like, you can still be a part of what we're doing. But we want to be super, super clear up front about what we're asking of people.
When it comes to that business development side that you mentioned, is, you know, collaboration with different businesses in the community something that's part of your workflow or Waterflow currently, or something on the roadmap?
Both. So we have done some collaborations thus far. We want to do more. We've worked with yoga studios who have donated a class to us and basically said, okay, anyone who comes to the class today, we're going to give a portion of our proceeds to Level in the Fields. We've worked with businesses that said, hey, we're doing an event. Why don't you come and set up a booth for awareness? So things like that we've done. We would like to do more. Sometimes we do end up going down a more of a partner road.
Yeah.
One of our partners is like the Rains Hotel Group, and they've been amazing. And so they actually had one of their hotels host our birthday party. And they gave us all the food for free, the space for free. It was really amazing. We were just so, so grateful. We're doing another event with them this fall. So in those types of collaborations, it's a lot deeper. Like, there's a real partnership there. And we would like to do more of that.
I appreciate you coming on and sharing your mission. And if anybody's listening and wants more details, I'll be adding those links to the show notes. Thanks for stopping by, Melissa.